So this is now the discussion session, and what we're trying to do here is generate some discussion. So me and Chris came with a bunch of questions and tried to merge them, so why don't you introduce this one?
So at AGN session, the most important question is, Omer, are they actually worthy of study? And what do other people think?
Well, don't ask me to
So more seriously, this digs into questions of what can we, at this point in time, given what we know, what can we learn about AGN and the accretion process, black hole accretion process in general? Some other sort of random questions that we jotted down from that is the analogy between AGN and X-ray binding still useful? I mean, we use it when we want to, and then we discard it when we don't like it. So there's theoretical reasons why the analogy may break down. There's observational reasons why it might break down, but it can be quite useful at times. What's going on with these changing look AGN? And this curious issue of the optical accretion disk size, is that actually solved now with Patrick's work on the real spectra or the more realistic spectra of disks? So let's throw this open to.
So.
Okay, wake up.
Jason. Brave man.
So one question I have along these lines is that it's often compared the X-ray variability between AGN and X-ray binaries, and then the statement would be from the variability point of view, I get the feeling it's all propagating fluctuations. It makes sense in both cases, the lags and everything. Mm. It's great. I think for people that study the optical UV variability of AGN, it's pretty different.
Yes.
And there, the feeling is that you can't have viscous fluctuations. The timescales that are observed are way too short. They're more like thermal times. Does anyone have any idea? I mean, is that the wrong comparison? Because the soft X-rays, the thermal part in the binaries don't even vary? Or are we? What's the answer there? What should we really be comparing?
If I could rephrase that question, should we even bother to study optical UV variability, or is it a waste of time because there's no model for it?
So, I mean, is there any objection to the usual notion that it's just all reprocessing?
Yeah. So if you look at the X-ray light curve of 5548, it's got way too much fast variability on it. And you see the lag. You can only lag on timescales that you smooth. The UV variability is very smooth. The X-ray variability is very spiky, but there's not a huge lag. And so this is a fundamental problem. You can't do it with light travel time reprocessing.
Christian?
Is it actually true that, in X-ray binaries and CVs or whatever, right, it's definitely true that it actually kind of doesn't matter where you look, what wavelength range you look, what frequencies you look, things like these fundamental fluctuation signatures, RMS blocks, red noise power laws with broken. You see those everywhere. You may have slightly different properties, but they'll have, you see these fundamental phenomenological signatures no matter what you do. So is it true that in AGN, if I look at an AGN Seyfert light curve in the UV, I didn't think that there was any evidence that it was any different. And if it is the same, then why the hell would I not? Why would I think that it's not?
So where does the variability come from in cataclysmic variable disks?
From the disk.
That was a theoretical question.
Oh. So, but my point is this, right? So presumably, if phenomenologically they all look the same, we shouldn't just basically explain the bits we can. if I like explaining X-ray fluctuations in AGN with a propagating fluctuation model because it happens to work, and then I see exactly the same phenomenology in the UV and in CVs and in X-ray binaries, and I can't get my model to work, presumably I don't just go, well, that's too bad.
Yeah. It's a timescale issue. I mean, the AG in the optical region of AGN disks, the timescales are enormous. I mean,
I thought your talk was the one that convinced me that maybe the timescale issue isn't such a big issue. Because usually the reason with timescale issues is everybody wants them to be viscous, and then you get horrible problems with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But you're telling us it's actually something to do with the dynamo, and nobody understands dynamos, so maybe it's fine.
Question.
Patrick.
So, Chris, about the light travel time issue, except for face-on disks, one radius maps to different time delays. Mm-hmm. So I'm not entirely convinced that we should abandon light travel time delay. Light travel time delay can produce a swift initial response and then a peak later and then this tail. So I think it still might work.
Give it a try. We modeled it in detail and we couldn't make it.
Fair enough.
Other discussion points on this, on any of these issues? What about this changing look AGM?
I was going to echo that because I need to apologize to Chelsea for giving my talk right before her talk. So we need to talk about changing look AGM.
What's going on with these?
They are AGM called quasars, and then Felix Mirabel invented the name microquasars, applied to X-ray binaries. My question is, have we learned anything about microquasars by studying quasars?
You don't want to hear my answer to that question.
In some sense, that's question two, isn't it?
But I want, come on.
So yeah.
Let's focus on number three.
Because
Chelsea's hand was up.
Yes.
Chelsea.
So relating back to
Chris, just one question. The question is still useful, and my point is was never used.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Chelsea.
So going back to what you were saying about reprocessing for the changing look AGN and quasars that happen to have X-ray observations in the previous and state and the different states. All of them seem to show that, you know, there is some sort of reprocessing going on. In other words, the X-ray flares lead, you know, the UV optical variability in the few cases where there are data. But of course, in 5548, you know, you don't see this reprocessing from the X-rays. So I'm wondering, maybe that could be a clue with something different going on in these AGN. I don't know.
So I was wanting to ask, in terms of the changing look AGN, the optical is going through the floor. If that's a real change in the accretion flow, how does that work? Because the timescales, again, we're on the timescale problem. The timescales are too fast.
Yeah, on the changing look AGN, we had the discussion with Chelsea and Joe over lunch yesterday. I think a very important point to nail down there is the question that Patrick asked: what is the shortest timescale on which you see them changing?
Yes.
And I think that will give a lot of information on what is actually going on, if this is something that is driven by the disk and illumination and etc., or if it's something else. So I would urge everybody that, you know, you actually keep an eye out for these and take repeated spectral observations of these.
Okay, I'm seeing Daniel and then I'm seeing Christian.
So you're going to monitor them for us with high cadence, is that right?
So we did the calculations.
And we'll monitor at least 2,000 AGN on a daily basis. So with the fraction, I think we came out to 0.1% of quasars that should have this changing look behavior. So there's a couple of tens or so that we should find in there. And then we also need to take regular spectral observations of those. That's not yet in the works, but we'll find a number of them, yeah.
And so the concern, I guess, is that, you know, what are you learning by observing the extreme oddballs of a population, right, about general accretion disks? But another way to look at it is that the changing looks may not necessarily be oddballs. It may just be that you're observing behavior that only, you know, that occurs on 10 to the 5-year time scales. AGN maybe live for 10 to the 8 years, and that's why 0.1% of them are changing look at any given time. That's another way that you might think about it, and then you're actually learning a lot about accretion disks by just observing these weird objects on human timescales.
Well, yeah, that's always a worry.
Right.
What in there is a Rosetta Stone that we really need to to focus on, where it's showing us physics that we couldn't otherwise get at, and what's just a weirdo oddball that'll lead us nowhere. Daniel.
So the changing log AGN, I have a question to everyone, but Oleg in particular. So maybe there's a connection between that and AGN feedback, that what we see is the AGN affecting the its environment on large scales, and unfortunately not very much related to AGN accretion, this, but on the supply.
So you mean in terms of obscuration or the supply of mass or?
Or whatever is between the source and us, you know, expelling, evaporating.
Yeah, you mentioned this in 1 year, that's the question, right? And even if it's an obscuration on the scale that you'd like to be obscuring at 1 year is like nothing.
So you think the answer is no?
I just had a really simple question for Chelsea, actually, which I've always wondered about, and I think it's been answered, but I don't know what it is. If I take a changing look quasar or AGN, right, and if I take it in the high state, right, and I know the SED and I know the line profiles, and if you then go and take the SED in the low state, and you take a photoionization model, the sort of typical photoionization models people have used to explain the BLR in the high states, if I do nothing but keep everything the same but just change the ionization, so just change the SED, do I get the right answer, or does something have to change in the BLR dynamically, like in the...
we were just... What is your name again?
Nick Tubman.
So I'm gonna do that calculation and try to see if, you know, just calculate the change in ionizing flux that you would need to just make the line disappear. And if so, then that would be argument that, yeah, maybe it's just the ionizing flux change.
Okay. In this context, in a lot of contexts, people invoke reprocessing. If you invoke reprocessing, you should consider your prediction for what happens in the Lyman continuum, because in accord with what you might think intuitively, and according to some Schinzel and Krolik papers, reprocessing is almost necessarily accompanied by big Lyman continuum emission. And so you should see if your model predicts Lyman continuum emission. And even if you can't observe your object in the Lyman continuum, I can tell you the answer. There isn't any, because since AGN were discovered, no one has ever seen any Lyman continuum emission in any object.
Christian?
Yeah. I mean, I think I broadly agree, but I think there actually is some evidence in systems like 5548 and a couple of others. So people like Mike Goad and Kirk Arista have pointed out that there may actually be a diffuse continuum signature in some of these signatures in the reverberation map. So if you look at the lag signatures, there seems to be actually hints of stuff going on that is in the Balmer edge, not the Lyman edge, but you can't observe the Lyman edge.
Well, that's from the BLR, and that's acceptable and mainstream, and that's probably correct. But that's from the BLR. That's if you want to do something like flatten the key of our profile, or make your disk bigger, or propagate energy by external illumination so that you can get correlations between X-ray and the optical UV. In other words, I'm talking about in the radiated disk, not in the radiated BLR. The radiated BLR does show diffuse components with lags as expected.
I guess I would argue that we shouldn't be so sure that the BLR and the disks are really completely separate things.
Okay. Do we want to move to Jean-Pierre's question, or do I want to you two
are in charge? Okay. So I think yeah, we want to keep on hitting more general questions. So what was Jean-Pierre's?
Have we learned anything about microquasars from quasars? That was a question, I think.
Anyone want to talk about microquasars?
Richard was tentative with that.
Right. It's a dreadful name. Let's just call them black hole binaries.
Well, we can maybe hit this is on the next slide as well.
Hey,
so but I mean, you know, crossover. We have some question from Richard.
Have courage.
Yes.
What's a crossover question for My impression from looking at observations of AGN is that they're very often accompanied by these very, very well-confined jets with a lot of power in them. I don't see that type of structure necessarily coming out of these MHD simulations. Mm-hmm. And I got the impression that the energy that comes out of the jets is somewhat lower than what you would get from the observational, well, from making an estimate of what's coming out in the observation. So I'm just wondering if there's kind of an important missing piece of the jigsaw puzzle here, is how these highly collimated jets are actually being launched, and whether or not there's something specific about the magnetic field structure or whatever that is missing from the simulations at the present time.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, I think Sasha has to answer
over
that.
To Sasha.
Yes.
Thanks for the question. We actually do see very strong jets, and the strength of the jets, at least in the MHD simulations without radiation, is determined by the availability of large-scale magnetic flux around the black hole. There was this big question, where does flux comes from? And there are several possibilities. One is that it's just dragged from large distances. And if you take a 100 parsec by 100 parsec square, cut it out, take all the flux from it and dump it in the black hole, it's more than enough to get a really strong jet. So if the accretion disks can grab the flux from the Bondi radius, like 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 gravitational radii, all the way down to the black hole, it will be more than sufficient to power the strongest jet you ever imagined, with the jet power equal to the accretion power. So power of the jet, m dot c, equal to m dot c squared, or of order of it, could even exceed that by a little bit, factor of maybe 2 or 3. If you say that
from a thin disk as well as from a thick disk?
Great question. So for thick disks, for sure. For thinner disks, the rescaling of jet power with the thickness of the disk, I'm finding linear dependence, at least down to h over r of about 0.1. So h over r of 0.3 will be 3 times more powerful than h over r of 0.1. I'm not aware of anyone trying to go below that. It's an interesting question.
How about question two?
Yeah. Yeah. So, was there any other part of this question? Oh, and also, as I showed, if you don't have vertical flux, if it's poloidal, for instance, you can still get a pretty good jet with jet power about 10% of accretion rate.
Sure. So I don't know what would provide a continuous source of net flux for the accretion disk in these types of systems. I imagine that the material that's fed in brings with it magnetic field of varying polarity. So seems to me that you would expect to see some kind of intermittency associated with the jet that's been launched in the black hole. So I think an interesting thing might be to look at whether or not, you know, the kind of time variability that you can discern from the images of the jets can be somehow matched by the simulations in terms of the time scales over which the magnetic flux reverses and things like that. Seems to me there might be some diagnostics in that as well that could be of interest. How long do you expect it to take for magnetic flux to reverse? There'll be a period where the jet presumably dies off for a while and then comes back to life, and it'd be interesting to see whether or not you could do something with the numbers and then compare the simulations with the observations.
This is definitely a really important issue to look into. The problem is the disparity of scales. The feeding length scales are huge if you measure them in the units of black hole scale. The time scale separation becomes even worse because it goes as radius length scale to 3/2. So far, nobody has been able to get a simulation, one go from the feeding scales down to the black hole event horizon. So we don't quite yet know how to answer this question that you're posing. Most likely, the time variability on those long time scales will be set by the process that feeds the black hole. So I would say my best guess would be it's a viscous time scale. If the large scale magnetic flux is generated at larger scales in the accretion disk, then it would be some sort of dynamo time scale on the feeding scales. That would be my best guess.
So one related comment to that though is, from an observational point of view, if you look at FR2 radio galaxies and look at the distribution of their sizes, this is some ancient stuff. Look at the distribution of their sizes. It's actually kind of funny distribution in that there's a lot of small compact sources compared to the number of large sources. So you try and connect them in an evolutionary model, it works best if the jet is intermittent and you kind of pulse it like this as it goes out. And the classic, the time scale, just purely empirically, the time scales you need to do that are like 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 years. So it's much faster than a fueling time.
The idea that you have these compact cold clouds, they will bring magnetic flux with them. That might be the source of the flux which eventually makes its way to the black hole. And you could then think about how long it takes the flux that they bring in to make its way down towards the event horizon.
Is that a really stupid and basic question? But so in the observational X-ray binary fields, everybody always goes on about how jet launching is completely not understood and nobody has the faintest clue how to link it to disks and stuff. And yet yesterday we saw all these simulations and apparently you can't get rid of the damn things. So what I didn't actually get is, what the hell drives your jets? I thought even that was completely not understood, and yet you seem to see them all the time.
So I did a lot of simplification for this talk, as you may have noticed, just to fit it within the time and perhaps make it more dramatic. But what I didn't touch upon at all is the question of transient jets and black hole binaries, which are the most powerful jets. Oh, okay, so the driving mechanism is the most of the power is coming from the rotation of the black hole by the Blanford-Znaik effect, yes. That's most of it. So I had backup slides that show you the breakup of jet power into the black hole component and the disk component. So if you saturate the black hole to this mad state where the black hole magnetic flux is as strong as the disk can hold, then the jet power at the maximum spin is about 5 times larger than the accretion disk outflow power. So the black hole outshines the disk by a factor of 5. And if I bring the spin down to 0, then the jet power from the black hole goes down to 0. But the disk still provides an outflow of about Novikov-Thorne efficiency for a non-spinning black hole, about 6%.
And what is the mechanism for that?
You can call it Blanford pain. Some people argue that it's not Blanford pain, but to me, it doesn't. It's magnetic.
It's the fun and warp jet. It's the accretion powered jet.
You can call it that. But basically, in both cases, I don't really see big difference fundamentally between jet powered by a black hole and jet powered by the disk, except for the baryon loading fraction. The black hole jets are clean. That's why they will be able to accelerate to huge Lorentz factors, because there's essentially no baryons, because they're blocked from crossing from the disk into the funnel by the magnetic flux and the centrifugal barrier. From the disk, there is a lot of baryons because the disk is baryons, made of baryons, so those outflows will be slower, maybe Lorentz factor of 2 or so at the most. But in principle, it's the same mechanism. You have a foot point of a field line that's rotating at the base, and if you come to the gym, you have a climbing rope, and you do that, then there will be a wave that propagates. That's how the energy comes out from rotation. There could also be thermal and radiative driving, of course, but at least in these non-radiative accretion flows, magnetic fields seem to be doing most of the work.
Okay.
Just a small correction, Sasha. In the case of rotating, of extracting rotational energy, it is rotational energy. In the case of the disk, it is gravitational energy. And this is the difference. And you can get rotational energy from a black hole only from a black hole. And maybe the question, how do we get relativistic jets from thin disks, is, I don't think it is what you suggest. It's the same as how do you get jets at all from any object, neutron stars, young stars. Would you say if you don't have a black hole, you have a jet anyway with your simulation?
Binary discussions are best done over lunch. So
yeah,
we can
talk more about this, but
yeah,
but fundamentally, you can convert into rotation gravitational energy, right? That's why you're rotating at Keplerian rate. So I think you can, if you take a step back and ask, what launches the jet? That would be a rotation of the foot point of the field line. And once, if you were to remove the source of rotation, the black hole or the disk, and just take the hand of God and rotate the field line, borrowing from your terminology. I just learned that from Jean-Pierre. Then you will get the same answer, essentially. All you care about is the omega of the field line, and that's it.
Jake.
Yeah, so sort of directed at Sasha, but in general, could there be any connection? Sorry, I had my hand up. When
oh, really?
He was,
really?
Yeah, so could there be any connection between the dynamo and jet stuff? So, I mean, I know the dynamo is primarily toroidal field, but there's some poloidal field there, too, and maybe in the rising of magnetic field structures, you get vertical field that may then propagate inwards and launch.
So, I mean, this is an excellent question. And just inject one thing at this point, which is, of course, a class of source that we have barely discussed. I mean, I think Chelsea mentioned them in passing, tidal disruption events. And the famous Jetted tidal disruption event, there's this classic problem that if you want it to be Blampers-Nayak, there's not enough flux. I mean, you know what your accretor was. Your accretor was a star, and you could take all of the flux in that star and stuff it into the black hole, and there's still not enough flux to power Blampers-Nayak jet. So, I mean, Sasha had ideas about pre-existing disks, but maybe, you know, if there is a dynamo, that could be the explanation for that that system.
So we've heard a lot of more theoretically based discussion, observationally based discussion as well. This is about theory confronting observations. We know we have dramatically relativistic jets in the FR and in the FR2s. We have them in the FR1s as well, but they're from low mass accretion rate flows. These are jets with bulk Lorentz factors of 15. We don't see them very often. Generally, so from the black hole binaries, it's Lorentz factors of 1.5. I think these things are very different. So, discussion. Observations confront theoretical models.
The FSRQs and the FR2s.
Sorry?
Of these very fast.
What makes a very fast jet? Or rather, why don't black hole binaries have bulk Lorentz factors of 15 in their jets?
Deer in the headlights.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, one of the reasons why poor Sasha is having to defend his field is that we don't have many jet people here. So, Sasha tried the. I was not an organizer of the conference.
So, it's possible that black hole binaries do have these fast outflows. Mm-hmm. It's just the black hole binaries lack instabilities that AGN jets have because of the differences in the ambient medium distribution. And those instabilities would light up the jets in AGN case and those features that propagate really fast, but not in black hole binaries. Could that be one possible explanation?
Maybe.
Well, one other aspect is there's actually a small handful of X-ray binaries that we all love and study. Okay, there's a few dozen of them. We study hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of AGN. Could this just be that you know, it's such a small opening angle, such a tight beaming factor, that they're there, we're just never well situated to see them? Is that possible?
Okay, someone else brave enough to enter this discussion.
I think the problem with the jets in the black hole binaries is that we are, in the radio observations, we only have the sensitivity to detect them when they're going up in the queue and then to the left, right? So when they make the state transition and they emit a powerful jet, it's very difficult to find those jets when they're in the quiescent low state. So I think it's partly a sensitivity issue why we don't see them.
May I address the second point?
Yes.
Do you mean that that you simulate, or that they simulate, thick disk realistically?
Right. So, MRI disk people, this is your chance to shine. We're going away from the jets.
I'm going to turn Jean-Pierre's question around. So I would love to see somebody realistically simulate these thin disks in these AMC-VN systems that I talked about. So a white dwarf accretor accreting from another white dwarf. They're tiny little systems. They have very low mass accretion rates. I would love to see a realistic simulation of that.
Well, I thought the Matt already showed the movies of simulation like that.
So AMCVN disks, global disks are being simulated now. We're still working on adding more physics, but that's in the pipeline.
It was not so much with you as with the whole.
Can you make them stable at the sorts of luminosities we see black hole binary disks?
I mean, it's you don't get that high Eddington usually in AMCVNs.
Yeah. Mm.
So
we see observationally beautiful disks at half Eddington in black hole binaries. They are still radiation pressure unstable.
How thin are realistic disks?
Chris, how thin are disks?
I don't think we have observational, but I do know that H upon R of 0.1 feels too thick for a thin disk. There are some binaries where we know we're looking at 80 degrees.
No, but how thin are realistic disks? Because we've won. This is HR.
Theorists, how thin do you think a realistic disk is?
Jean-Marie. Oh, no.
Theorist
actually knows the observational situation.
Well, if I remember correctly, in... in binaries, HOR should be of a few percent at most, and in AGNs, the H over R you find from if you integrate the vertical equation of a disk is much less than a percent. So thin disk, in principle, should be extremely thin.
So,
what?
But this is already based on the theory.
No, so from observations. So from the observations in CVs, we know that the vertical extent of the hotspot, which we often assume is the outside of the disk, is a few degrees, as seen from the white dwarf. So it's like 3 degrees. Angle to the white dwarf. That's it. I just make a comment from a theoretical point of view. I think there is a big difference. I think the way I will ask the second question is that how to simulate a disk with a few percent accretion rate is not really to ask how to simulate a thin disk. We want to ask if you simulate a disk with a few percent accretion rate, what exactly is the structure of the disk? Because really the question normally people ask HOR, there's a big difference in the gas pressure dome regime and the radiation pressure dome regimes. For the MCVN disks, the gas pressure dominant. So when you consider the vertical hydrostatic equilibrium, I mean, because the gas pressure, you roughly get the classical scale height definition because you need the pressure gradient to support gravity. And for the simulation mesh shells, it's actually a few degrees for the scale height. So that is consistent. But the things totally change when you're in the radiation dome regimes. I think Omar made a point where clearly if you're in the strong radiation dome regimes, you can perfectly satisfy vertical hydrostatic gradient by constructing fluffs increase the height linearly, but they have nothing to do with density. The density is not constrained by hydrostatic gradient. So the theoretical, the classical argument for the scale height based on hydrostatic equilibrium does not apply to the radiation dome regimes. And the thing that says the density scale height really the dissipation. What is the vertical structure of the dissipation where you put the energy is? So I did show one simulation for AGNs with a few percent Eddington accretion rate. So the scale height of HR is smaller than like 10% by like a few percent. But the real thing that the is because of the change of the dissipation and also the support of the magnetic pressure and the radiation pressure is not as thin as you will normally think based on the hydrostatic equilibrium conditions.
So I just want to make a quick point in like bringing theory and observation together. We shouldn't forget that when we talk about, when observers and theorists talk H, we're not talking about the same thing. You guys keep talking about pressure scale heights or density scale heights at best, but what we observe are at best something like photospheric heights. The two may not have anything to do with each other. And it's even worse in a disk. It's not even the vertical photospheric scale height. It's whatever the hell it is where tau equals one hits tau equals one along your line of sight across the top of the atmosphere. That may or may not be anything to do with what you measure.
Okay, so we've got a little less than 10 minutes, so I propose we move on to thick disks. So we had some nice talks today, very nice talks, especially directed towards understanding the EHT data, but in general about the more rates for inefficient flows. So these are some questions we put up, and just as a starting point for discussion, something I'm interested in is, for example, for really modeling what's really going on in something like Sagittarius Star, which we need to confront for the EHT, how important is the really difficult plasma physics? You know, the thermalization, the partitioning of the heating into electrons and protons, the thermalization of the electrons and protons once it's partitioned off, you know, is probably not just Coulomb, which everyone's assuming right now. So how important is the plasma physics and how can we get a handle on that? There's the basic nature of the low hard state and the turbulence. There's the collapse process we heard about from Pratik today about what happens when we actually do collapse from collapse to hot flow. And then I put this up more as a question to the observers, which is how robustly do we know whether there are super Eddington AGN? I mean, something which doesn't involve some nasty model-dependent extrapolation into the extreme ultraviolet. Okay, something where there's honest-to-goodness, robust, bulletproof arguments that Eddington that actually are super Eddington AGN. So there's a bunch of questions. Any takers? They're getting tired. Come on, 10 more minutes, 5 more minutes.
I mean, quickly on the first one, I think, you know, we have a much better understanding of how the plasma physics affects things and probably what is going on than we did before in even the earlier models that I was showing. So I actually think that's an area of important recent progress from.
So this is the, you know,
this Sasha et al. And others.
This formula for partitioning.
I mean, just at least that I think the crucial issue is the electron temperature, and that, yes, this idea that the electrons get heated in the magnetized region. Yeah. This is really important, and it definitely matters for the images, just put it that way, right? You see the electrons, radiate is very important.
So it matters, so therefore we better get it right.
Well, I think also we need to understand how to link the different prescriptions to the data, because, I mean, you should be able to actually see it, I think.
So I think the observations are sensitive to TE, not essentially, it does depend on heating the electrons in the magnetically dominated regions, but I would not take any prescription very serious, you know. I'll not take the exact form and nature of the prescription very seriously because they're not really tested in these regimes. But you know, we can just go about it like this, that, you know, what do you need for heating to be, you know, crudely, to get or model the observations and then try to constrain that.
So if we go to our, you know, computational plasma colleagues who are burning hundreds of millions of CPU hours on 3D PIC, I mean, is this a soluble problem? To really look at both the partitioning and the thermalization.
I guess quickly, I just also ask Pratik or Sasha to comment. So there's other, you know, pressure anisotropy or other plasma effects. Are those now, is the feeling now that those are not important and the temperature, the heating is really the only thing that we need to get? Or are there others that haven't even been addressed yet?
Those are two I can take first. So I think physics-wise, the importance of pressure anisotropy and heating is very, very important. And I think the background shear, there is a background shear and a significant amount of energy is directly dissipated by that has to be kept in mind. The processes that Greg House described in his 2010 paper is sort of a cascade. how much of the energy goes into the turbulent cascade and is eventually dissipated is the question that he addresses. So, you know, both of them are important, but Sasha has really done a lot of recent work, so I'd really like to hear what he has to say.
Well, that's okay, because I want to push on to the variability. But
yeah, so Sasha, I'll let the plasma people. Just a few seconds.
Thank you. Did I fit in the time? This is a really good point that you raised, and you also asked me during the talk. There are microphysical electron instabilities. You know, when you shear something, magnetic field gets amplified, the pressure in a certain wave of electrons grows, and then the electrons hit either one or the other, instability situation limit mirror or fire hose. And so those things were looked at by Mani Chandra and by Francois Foucault. So two things that I want to say about that. Thing number one is that they don't seem to change the dynamics of the accretion flow as much as you would think. So these are collisionless processes, but you would think that they would manifest themselves in large scales through extra viscosity, mass accretion rate will go up. It doesn't seem like it changes things by more than 10%. So that means that MHD actually does much better than you would have expected, given that the underlying physics, plasma physics, is kinetic and collisionless. Number two is, how does it affect the heating of electrons? It seems like it slightly increases the heating of electrons in the midplane, but it doesn't seem to change anything else and doesn't seem to affect the spectra and the variability too much. So you basically effectively have a floor on the electron heating fraction in the accretion flow of about 0.1. That's a rough way that you can include that extra heating from these instabilities due to this anisotropic pressure of electrons. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
There's question at the back.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering, with regards to the second question, when we're talking about variability, right? So we're going to go with these simulations and say that the dynamo is stirring up these fluctuations on extremely fast timescales, and maybe the MRI is stirring up fluctuations on the viscous timescale, and that's cool. But we need communication of these fluctuations if we're going to do any kind of variability correlated with energy spectra. So I'd be interested to find out about people, their thoughts on thermodynamics and how thermodynamic effects are going to destroy these fluctuations, convection currents in the flow, for instance.
Okay, these are directly observable things. Let's go this one first.
Well, so, you know, from my simulations in dwarf novae, you can disrupt magnetic field. You can disrupt magnetic field reversals of the dynamo with convection. If you look at AGN, you can get that same temperature regime, although much lower densities. And so, could you also get convection there, which damps field reversals? That's a possibility. It's speculation, and so maybe that. I don't know exactly how you can translate that into an observable, but you can then, if you want to say, oh, now you're damping these reversals, then...
Well, it's that much more difficult with AGN, right? Because you've got all the stuff in the way that's obscuring any observations of fluctuations. So it would be interesting to find out in black hole binaries, for instance, where we could expect maybe to see these fluctuations, is our thermodynamics having a serious effect in the flow and in the disk there to destroy any knowledge we might have about coherence?
Okay, and for Paul, last word to Paul.
Yeah, so in listening to this discussion, I thought of something that I just throw out. In plasma physics, there's something called the Dreiser electric field, and if you have electric fields below the Dreiser field, then MHD is a valid theory. You can... But if fields are above the Dreiser field, then you get runaway electrons, and they go relativistic, and this is seen in experiments, so on. So it seems to me an interesting thing to look at in these models would be to see what electric fields you have. You need to know really three things: the density, the temperature, and the electric field, and then you could see whether you're above or below the Dreiser field, and if you're above it, then you're going to get relativistic particles, and forget about MHD. And if you're below it, you won't. So that, if you're talking about things being you know, relativistic and having x-rays and so on, it could easily be that you made a transition to go above the Dreiser electric field. So that's something I suggest looking for.
Thanks.
Over to Emma.
So I want to make it clear that I'm giving them credit, not blame, that I had nothing to do with the organization of this conference. Thankfully, organizing the program, I've got tons of help from my fellow coordinators and scientific advisors, but they took this completely off my shoulders, and I am incredibly grateful to them. So Catherine Espelot, Christian Kanige, Jim Stone, who has had to leave, unfortunately, to catch a flight back to the East Coast, and Jean-Pierre Lasada, I really want to thank them profusely for organizing this, and I think we all owe them a round of applause. But then, perhaps even more than that, than thanking them, you know, organizing programs and conferences at the KITP is almost effortless, thanks to the incredible staff that they have here. And I want to thank Craig Kunimoto and his team. You may have noticed that somehow, you know, something's wrong with my laptop or something, and immediately, seconds later, someone comes down and helps out fixing it. This is magic, right? I mean, they've been watching your talks and making sure that everything is going smoothly. And so let me get this, Elena, Ash and Lane, there's a person named Richard Carini, who's actually been doing all the recording, and of course Doug Early, who is organizing this whole effort to get your talks up online. So they are online, by the way. Hope you know that. and then finally, I would like to thank Larry Staggs and Viviana Rojas for doing a ton of background work just to get the logistics of this conference right, and above all, Claudia Gutierrez, who's the KITB conference coordinator. She has basically got you all here. She's organized everything, and I really want to thank her, and all your fellow staff members profusely for making this such an effortless effort. So I hope you've all removed your posters, and there is lunch available.